You're listening to a download from theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Number 499.
Hello and welcome back to The Outdoor Station with me, Bob Cartwright, your host of the longest running outdoors podcast dedicated to the self-powered traveller. Sorry I missed the show last week. The studio build has taken over my life. And now, after 6 coats of paint, I think the walls and ceilings are now definitely white. Mostly, apart from that bit in the corner. Next comes the fitting of the lighting support rails, and after that, the flooring. And then, obviously, the electrics and naturally all the other things that go along, but one thing at a time. We will get there in the end, but it does seem like it's taken over every hour. Of course, the next podcast is the Big 500, and I've actually lost track of the total number of downloads since we passed the 14 million mark during the 14 years that we've been doing it. Yes, the very first release was back in October 2005, and look how the digital landscape has changed since then. Maybe that's something to reflect on in the next production. Now then, how many of you listening would like to try wild camping, but you haven't as yet due to various understandable concerns? You may be unsure about the legality of where to go, especially in England and Wales. It might be that you like the idea of solitude and the dark open skies, but would really like to have some kind of safety net nearby. You may want to light a campfire, but you could be unsure about how to go about it safely without obviously damaging the local habitat. And of course, many folk have understandable hygiene issues and concerns about where or how to go to the loo in the wilds. And of course, how to obtain clean drinking water. So in a nutshell, you have perhaps a small tent, a hammock, tarp or bivy. You want to go somewhere remote, but not too far from your car and a loo. And you may be wanting to disconnect from power so you can see the stars at night while you sit and cook over an open fire. Somewhere you might camp as a solo or a couple, a small group or a small family. Somewhere remote but safe. Exciting but unfamiliar. Somewhere, well, you could describe it as nearly wild camping. Well, I've stumbled across a membership cooperative website which offers all that, and coincidentally is called nearlywildcamping.org. Started only a few years back by Steve and Irene Everson, it fills that huge gap between commercial campsites with all the facilities, the swimming pools, the tennis courts, the play areas, etc., etc., and the other end of the scale, total, pure, remote, wild camping, miles from anywhere, with nothing around. It all began on their remote farm on the Shropshire-Powys border, where they offered a basic but remote opportunity for people to dip their toes into the wild camping water, so to speak, as Steve now explains.
Nearly Wild Camping, right. Well, we started off from a small holding on the Welsh border, and we were getting people coming and camping at the farm and really enjoying it, but we didn't want to run a campsite. We ourselves do a lot of camping. Particularly really wild stuff. I do quite a lot of mountaineering, a lot of time working in pretty wild places overseas, and felt that there was a gap because we didn't really want to go on campsites. We found the people that were coming to our place absolutely loved it, and we thought surely we can do this for other people and link up with other landowners who are willing to let people come and camp, have a wilder experience, and hopefully learn more about the countryside at the same time.
So what's the response been since you started this then?
Okay, well, it started off, as you can imagine, a bit chicken and egg, because the campers wanted more locations and the locations wanted more campers, and everybody kept saying, well, when are you going to be big enough? But what we did is we piloted it in the county of Powys in mid Wales, where we were managed to get a small grant from a LEADER project, which is a European fund. And that really enabled us to pilot it with 10 locations, work out what the offer ought to be, how it needed to look from the point of view of the camper, and then almost do some trial camping and see how it worked, see what the problems ended up sort of being. And then from that, we grew fairly slowly up to about the first 20 locations. Some of the early pilot ones realized it wasn't really for them. Some of the campers, I think, had got involved for probably the wrong reasons, not expecting it to be what we envisaged. And it grew slowly up to about probably 400 members, something like that. And then the last year and a bit, it's just taken off, and we're well over 1,000 members now and about 80 locations.
So it's a membership organisation then, and obviously I'll tell people exactly where the website is and they can go and have a look. But what will they see when they look at the website not being a member at the moment?
Okay, so yeah, it's a membership organisation. If you're not a member, what you'll see is the very basic, here's who we are, what we've got, and some rough idea of the sorts of locations. But to actually get into the detail of it, you have to join as a member. And the reason for that is fairly simple. We started off trialing a sort of almost like an Airbnb type model, where we just charged according to use. But that actually didn't work because a lot of the landowners aren't necessarily there all the time. They wanted to know who it was that was coming. They wanted a bit more of a rapport with the people that were coming. And so we went back to an old fashioned method where, you know, you book online through emails and phone people up, and that really seems to have worked. So from the point of view of what you see if you're not a member, it's relatively limited. You'll get a bit of a feel of what we do, get a bit of a feel of the scope of the organisation and where we cover, and then anything after that, you pay the £20 a year, and that gives you access to the directory and all the details about the 80-plus locations that we've got.
Certainly from our audience, there'll be a certain number of people that are happy and comfortable with wild camping, and there are many others who aspire to wild camping in that freedom, but obviously have that nervousness about where to go and what sort of experiences they might have and various fears they might have, be it hygiene or location or weather or whatever it may be. This is quite a novel idea in the sense that you're holding somebody's hand who perhaps wants to do it, but wants to do it with a certain amount of, certain small parachute, really, just that they know they're comfortably there. They know where they're going, I suppose. That's the bottom line, because I think a lot of people, the biggest fear is probably heading out into the hills and actually being unsure of where they're going and how to camp. So have you found that your audience that you've reached and the people that have given you feedback and so on fall into any particular categories? Are they people that are doing it for the first time and this is a sort of stepping stone before true wild camping?
I think you're absolutely right, Bob. I mean, yeah, as I said at the beginning, and obviously I've done a lot of really wild camping. I used to live out in Alaska and Tanzania and various places and been some pretty crazy places. And I think it is this thing that, for many people, that sounds so extreme, it's unreal. But even going wilder camping, say in Scotland or quietly up on the hills in Snowdonia or wherever, is way beyond where they're currently at. And there's also a number of people that I think have a particular need. So special groups, families, it can be difficult to wild camp because you actually want to leave the tent up for more than, you know, quick overnight. So yes, we've started finding that it is working for the people that we, I suppose, were targeting at. And that I think we'll probably break that down into people who have done camping before but are trying to get others in the family or friends into camping. And they want to get them out into doing something that's a bit closer to the countryside than a standard campsite with all the hookups and lighting and paraphernalia that now seems to go with most campsites. We've got the people who have done quite a lot of camping but never really dared go beyond the bounds of the normal places, and they don't know very much about I suppose the countryside and how it works. Then they're not comfortable to go and knock on a landowner's door. Then we've got the people who are very new to it all, but know they've got this kind of dream of getting out there. And for them, going to a safe place where they can chat with the landowner and buy the eggs in the morning and get some firewood, and they know that what they're doing is allowed and safe, is really positive. And then, as I say, there's then some particular groupings that we've found are finding it very helpful. We've had a lot of positive feedback from single women who want to get out and wilder camp, but they don't like going on campsites because they feel everybody's sort of looking at them or they feel uncomfortable. They don't want to go out wild camping because they don't feel safe or comfortable. So this provides them a really nice middle ground. And then the final group is people who with particular needs. So we've had young carers. We've had some of the sort of special interest groups who want a place that they know they're camping, but it's only them going to be there. So they're not going to have to deal with lots of other issues that in many camp locations are quite difficult. So I think that's broadly the sort of groupings.
In the media, in the news at the moment, we'll all be encouraged to get outdoors more and get more exercise and so on. And there must be young families who are keen to try it, but they haven't had a background in it, as you say. And this is a safer option so that it gives the youngsters the experience of bushcraft and Raymeers or whatever. And the parents are confident that they are not trespassing or doing something inappropriate or illegal, I guess.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the thing that there's a bit of a hidden agenda. My background is actually ecology and land management, and yeah, I think there's a lot of there are a lot of landowners who are keen to help people learn more about the countryside and the natural world. And as you say, there's a lot of people who want to get out and do those sorts of things and want to be able to do it in a place where they know they're welcome. And there's also this other element, which is understanding what is and isn't good for the natural world, when you're damaging it and when you're not. And so being able to go onto these locations where often the landowners they're pretty knowledgeable, not all of them necessarily experienced in things like bushcraft, but they've got a good understanding of their land and the countryside and how it works. And they can help people learn a little bit along the way as well. And what we've done to try and help with that process is we've linked up with the John Muir Foundation and using the John Muir Award process so that people can think about, well, if they're there, maybe they're going to the same location a few times with their family. They can use that as a way of building up their experience and getting something that gives the kids, a credibility to what they're doing. It gives them a sequence of activity that they can work through, and it gives them an accreditation, which helps towards things like Duke of Edinburgh Award. So that can be really helpful. And we're now working on, let's call it a social weekend type approach, where people can come together for a weekend and learn the basics of things like Leave No Trace. But we like to call it Leave No Trace, Put Something Back. To also give people the idea of it's not just about going into a place and using it. It's also about how you impact on it and think about what else could you do to help. Maybe it's some volunteering or doing some citizen science or getting involved on the farm, doing some activities that help nature. So effectively you're putting something back in through your experience as well as having an enjoyable time away.
Looking at the website, there's, 82 locations you've got dotted around England and Wales. And I noticed there's one or two in Ireland and Scotland as well. And Scotland's obviously a bit of an unusual case because of the land access there. But could you possibly... You mentioned earlier on about somebody going to a location and there wasn't going to be anybody else there. Is that generally the rule that people have an area to themselves, or are other people likely to be there, and is there sort of a limit and space? I mean, basically, how much space is somebody going to have around them, as it were, in all of these locations? Is there a generalization? Do you have like a rule type of thing?
It's probably slightly looser than a rule, but if you're a certified location, so there's two or three different types of location. A few of the locations are ones that are open to, if you like, the public generally, and two or three, a small number of them are actually commercial locations, but they're ones where they give people plenty of space You haven't got other people driving their cars around near your tent. You know, usually the ones where any vehicular access is in a wood, so you've got a fair degree of privacy, and they're what we would call more of a one-star location. They've got a toilet and probably even a proper shower somewhere nearby that you can use. You've got the bulk of the locations, which probably only have up to about five units, but that can be five units over quite a big area. So my small holding would be probably a one or a two star. We have got a toilet and shower nearby, although everything is built with recycled materials, which is a bit unusual. We would have up to five small tents on an area which is about 3 acres. So, you know, you've got quite a lot of space. I rarely have more than one group of campers at any point in time. So we're not running them as commercial locations. We're running them purely to a bit more like, I suppose, a wild camping version of caravan club site or whatever. And some of them are really very spread out across the people's property, so you wouldn't see anybody else the whole time you were there.
Well, I was thinking five tents in how many acres did you say?
That was about 3 acres.
Acres. I mean, that's a good 200, 300 metres between a tent.
Plenty of space. We actually have a communal fire pit area, so if people want to go and sit with other people who are camping, if they are together, and that's mainly because we also use ours for groups. So we host groups on our location particularly. That's what we specialise in, because we're well set up for it and the site works really well for them. Other thing is we've recently been given our licence from the Welsh Government, so we can now operate certified sites, and those are for members only. And that's quite exciting because that means that now a landowner can sign up. They will say they'll only have a maximum of five tent units, they know who the people are that are coming. They know they're part of the organisation. They know what sort of experience they've got and so on. So it means that it's much easier for the landowner. It gives them a greater degree of cover, and it means the camper knows for definite it's only going to be other members of Nearly Wild Camping on that location. And that's a legal requirement of the certification licence. And we're currently waiting to get confirmation from DEFRA. We've just got to get a couple of basically they have like referencing system, and we just need to get that finished off, and hopefully that will then give us the same system in England.
When you sign up for the Outdoor Station newsletter, you have the option to give us feedback on our shows. You also have the opportunity to suggest people of interest you would like to hear more about. You can also suggest UK campsites which you feel may be unique, and cottage manufacturers who would appreciate a little exposure to our wider audience.
The Outdoor Station, sharing the passion, appreciation, and understanding for the outdoors world.
The people are listening to this at the moment. They may be falling into the trap of thinking that it's just a tent and a certain type of tent that would be suitable for these locations, depending on how they're looking at it. But this is for a much wider group, isn't it? It's also for people that just want a bivvy somewhere, that just want to use a tarp, even hammock campers. And I notice one or two sites will actually take small camper vans. Is that correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Bob. We've got quite a range. We've tried to not get into this thing of, I suppose, falling into the trap of accepting everything on the location. So the locations say what works for them, what works for the habitat or the way they manage their land. We've got, I think it's up to about 30% now have got places where you can hammock camp. I'm pleased to say that my small holding will be very soon. The trees are almost big enough. But a few of the places also accept vans. Really, we're not looking at big motorhomes, but people who've maybe got a converted transit or a V-dub or something, they can park. Usually it's on a hard standing or an area that's slightly separate from the tents, just to avoid vehicles in and around where people are sleeping. You're absolutely right. I mean, some of the sites are fantastic for bivvying or for putting a tarp up or whatever. So it's pretty flexible. And it really comes down to the individual locations and what they've got.
Well, that's what I was going to come on to next, is that you mention it or touch on it on the website, saying you've got a wildness rating, which goes from very, very basic and sounds like absolutely nothing at all apart from the land, through to other facilities. But presumably most people these days would want the basic of a some kind of toilet, and water is the lowest thing, I would say. But does it get even more basic than that?
Oh, yeah, it gets even more basic. I mean, I think we've got one or two that are actually literally pack it in, pack it out. But the bulk of them would be what we would call a 3-star, possibly a 2-star. So a 1-star has got facilities, I suppose, most people would expect: a toilet, a flush toilet, and a shower somewhere nearby. None of them will have sort of lighting and all that type of thing. But they will have the sort of the basic requirements. If you're going up to something like a 2-star or into a 3-star, then you're moving more and more towards more compost loos, and possibly a solar shower. Once you get up to a 4-star, it's probably a compost loo somewhere nearby, but nothing else. So it varies. The bulk of the sites are really have got some sort of toilet, either a flush toilet nearby or a compost loo, probably be the most common. And a few of them will have solar showers.
For each of the locations, do the landowners provide a sort of a handful of basic rules so people understand they're not crossing the line as regards affecting the environment negatively? And also, the natural thing would, of course, be dogs. A lot of people have dogs these days of all different shapes and sizes. Are they welcome?
Okay, Bob. So, yeah, I'm going to answer that slightly the other way around. So the dog question comes up regularly. Quite a few of the locations do accept dogs, but always on a lead. And we say on a lead rather than under control, because it is really difficult to judge what one person thinks of as control is not control by another. Particularly when you've got livestock around, people think their dog's under control, but they haven't actually had it in amongst sheep or chickens or cattle or whatever in the past. So they actually have a bit of a rude awakening when they find out it isn't. So we always ask people to keep the dogs on a lead. There will be some rules on each of the locations, and that's up to their location owner to let you know. It's usually put on the listing with information. And as I say, I always say to people, if you're not sure, just ask. You know, I have people asking, well, do you mind if our kids run around? Do you mind if we let the dog off over there? And I always try and be very clear with them, and I also explain why. And I'll give you one example that is quite interesting. We don't actually allow any vehicles on our fields. And people look at me a bit surprised. And I say, well, we've got a little trolley that you can pull all the camping kit down to the field with. And usually people have a lot of fun doing that. But the reason we don't is we don't actually put vehicles on the fields ourselves hardly ever. And the reason is because it creates compaction of the soil. We've got a number of interesting plants, including pyramidal orchids and bee orchids on our land. And so we're managing it for the wildlife. And the final reason we don't is because there's nothing worse than lying in a tent and having somebody drying a car just past your head. So we're all about trying to keep our spaces as quiet and secluded as we can. So, yeah, each place has rules, and they will let you know on the listing. And if you're not sure, ask the landowner.
You mentioned earlier on about various activities and also education, I suppose, that the landowner might share with the people who are camping there. It's not obligatory that they should do any of these educational activities, I trust. It's more a sharing of information, I would guess. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's totally up to the landowner. Yeah, I mean, most of them, it's really just they've got a bit of land they're willing to use, and that's it. But a few of them are also bushcraft teachers, or they're working outdoor education, or they may be furniture makers or whatever. So they've got other activities going in and around the land. And so they put things on if people want them or ask for them. And I've certainly run greenwood courses on the farm. We've done permaculture courses. We've done small activities when we've had maybe two or three families that want to do something together, and we've done things like making pots from the clay in the fields, proper, you know, using showing them how you process the clay and take it through to the final pot and so on. So, yeah, I mean, it depends on the landowner and what they want to offer. But interestingly, what we've started to do as a result is we've also recently been developing a thing called Nearly Wild. And I'd love to talk with you about that another time, Bob. But it's really helping people who are providing, if you like, nature-based experiences and running nature-based businesses, helping them promote what they're doing. And that includes the people who are running those sorts of businesses and allowing Nearly Wild camping on their land.
Well, certainly it's a fascinating subject, the green skills, green woodworking skills and other traditional crafts. And I've recently joined the Bodgers Society, and I was very surprised to see the list at the back of the booklet there of the skills which are actually dying out. Which nobody is continuing, and it's remarkable, really. When you read them, you know what they are, but it's hard to believe that they're actually falling into history.
Yeah, I think, well, it's interesting you say you know what they are, because I think probably, you know, somebody like yourself, Bob, would know what they are, but in many situations I find people really don't know what a lot of these skills are, and far too often I've taken people into what is basically a plantation, and they have no understanding that the woodland was actually planted by people. And when you then start showing them how the timber has been used, or how maybe coppice has been worked or whatever, that's completely alien to them. So I think that there's a whole body of understanding which is slowly being lost, and thank goodness for things like bushcraft and as you say, Bodgers and the greenwood movement and coppice workers and all the rest, keeping all that alive, because there's a huge amount of knowledge I think we do need to know, and we're probably going to need to know more about again, because we start to recognise that we need to live more in balance and with the natural world and the way we utilise it.
So as a generalisation, if people join, what's the membership fee, by the way?
The membership is £20 a year, and that makes you a member of the cooperative. So we're actually a co-op. I don't own it. I set it up. And the money that we use, that comes in from the members, is used to basically pay for the running of the directory, to pay for Lee, who does all the sort of day-to-day administration and management of the organisation. And it helps us go along to a small number of shows each year to basically promote what we're trying to do.
So does that £20, is that for an individual or for a family?
Okay, so the way we've got that structured at the moment is it's for an individual and their close family, so it's up to one other adult and three kids. But we are currently looking at whether we need to have two or three different levels of membership. Basically, we've had quite a few inquiries over the last sort of year and a half as we've grown as to whether there's a separate one for a single person, or whether if people want to come with two or three families and so on. So we're looking a little bit more carefully at that whole membership thing, but the aim is to keep that pricing down as low as we can, so it's not making anybody rich. It's there pure and simple to keep the organization functioning.
And the sites themselves, is there a flat fee for every site? Are they all the same price?
No, as with everything else with this, the locations vary quite significantly. But broadly speaking, I think that the bulk of the locations, if it's you with a small tent, not a sort of 8 meter square tent or something, but with a relatively small tent, and say a small family, then usually around £10-12 a night. And most of the locations allow things like firewood and so on, and you get a lot of privacy. So you're paying a lot less than most campsites, and you're getting really a lot more for it, unless you particularly want a hairdryer in the showers.
So with a £20 membership, a small family or whatever would be looking at £10 or £15 per night. They would have acres of space around them by the sound of it. But they'd also be in an area where I presume most of these sites are located, where they could do things like stargazing, bit of bushcraft, bit of green woodwork perhaps. And I would guess, obviously I'm not a member of the site, but I would guess each location gives an indication of what the landowner is able to share with them.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. So the on their listing, they'll tell you more about what they do. And then, as I say, we're now starting this another directory for people that offer a much broader range of sort of nature based activity. And that's going to be on the Nearly Wild website. But that's still very, very new and very young at the moment. But the broadly speaking, if you're not sure, ask the person that runs the location. They'll tell you. They'll tell you if their woodland is going to be damaged by you cutting wood, or if they're happy for you to. They'll let you know how they work their animals. You know, it's very much a case by case. The listings will tell you, but if you're not sure, just ask the landowner. You know, they're all really friendly and helpful. So.
Great. Okay. And I suppose this day and age, with people going out with families, doing something they're not that comfortable with or not that familiar with, as regards the rural locations and it being fairly raw compared to a sort of commercial campsite, has to ask the question: what about insurance and that type of thing? Are all the sites covered in case of sort of, I don't know, some sort of accident?
Well, we recommend to all the locations that they should have, as a minimum, their sort of public liability insurances and so on. It's up to them to ensure that obviously they have all the right things for their particular location, because, again, it's going to differ depending on whether it's a commercial forest area or whether it's a working farm or it's small holding or whatever. But we strongly recommend to them always that they should have those insurances in place.
So somebody listening to this that may have perhaps a couple of acres spare, what's the criteria that you look for somebody to provide this sort of facility for people?
Well, it's really quite straightforward. I mean, the best thing they can do is have a quick look at the Nearly Wild Camping website. There's plenty of information on there. But if they've got any queries, so send a quick email in and Lee will send them further information. I would always recommend to people they look carefully at particularly two key things. One, as you rightly point out, is the insurance, and the other is that they're going to be okay with regard to sanitation. The sanitation, I think that compost loos can work extremely well. So often we're finding people are putting those in or coming up with some type of composting system if they haven't got access to some sort of flush toilet nearby. And then it's a question of working out which bit of their land they want to use, whether they want it to be a certified location and therefore only used by Nearly Wild Camping members, and think very carefully about how they want it to operate. Because if they're really, their dream is to run a sort of, in the future, a larger commercial site, then we're not really the right type of organisation for them. We are very much about trying to provide that wilder experience for people, and also the opportunity for people to come and learn about the countryside. But if somebody's only got a small acreage, I mean, we've had people say, well, I've only got half an acre. Have I got enough land? And my only response to that can be, well, yes, so long as it's not surrounded by tower blocks, because obviously then it's not going to feel very wild. However, in certain situations, even there, it might be appropriate. And I think it's really, this is where the wildness rating comes in so valuably, along with the feedback from campers when they go. And they say how they felt about it, how wild it was for them. So, yeah, if somebody's interested as a landowner, take a look at the website and please get in touch.
If you look at the website nearlywildcamping.org, you'll see a map with a rough indication of many sites dotted around the UK. So if you're a hiker, cyclist, hammock camper, bushcrafter, small group or intrepid family, I'm sure there's somewhere local for you to try wild camping in this format. Membership at only £20 is certainly affordable, and it could open the doors for you to meet like-minded people, learn about rural life, and of course, cook over an open fire. My thanks to Steve for taking the time to chat with me, and I do hope this idea continues to grow. It really does fill a gap in the outdoors experience market, which I'm sure many people of all ages would be curious to try. It is, of course, the big 500th podcast next time, folks. So, until then, bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorsstation.co.uk.